I'm going to gavel in an informational meeting, beginning with Sandy Cutler we have here today. He's a state director of the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network, and he's going to give us a quick overview of what they do. Welcome, Mr. Cutler. Thank you for coming.
Chair Smith and members of the committee, thank you for the record. My name is Sandy Cutler, and I'm the state director for the Small Business Development Center Network. And what I'd like to do today is just take a few minutes to very quickly run through the importance of small business to the Oregon economy and why we have a Small Business Development Center program. And if I could, I'd like to just take a moment to go back 20 years, because that's when this whole thing began, in 1982 and 1983, when the Oregon economy once again was in the depths of a terrible recession. Unemployment at Lane County at that point in time was 16%. And the prime lending rate for businesses to borrow money was 21%. And businesses were floundering, and everybody was seeking solutions. How can we do something to stimulate the economy, to diversify the economy? And then Representative Bill Bradbury suggested that we create a program to help small businesses by giving them assistance through the community colleges. So that's the origins of this program. Very quickly, an overview of small business in Oregon. We have a lot of small businesses. In fact, we rank 17th in the United States in new business starts. There's over 296,000 small businesses. Now, it's important to understand that a lot of those are sole proprietors. Those would be people that actually end up filing a Schedule C as part of their income tax return. We're 21st in the United States in business failures, which isn't great, but it's not bad. 99% of the businesses in the state have 99 fewer employees, 96% have 50 or less, 94% have 20 or fewer, and 76% have 5 or less. And that gets to the point I'll show you on the next slide. We actually have a lot of very, very small businesses. It's also important to note that small businesses in Oregon employ 49%, almost half of the workforce. We're very reliant on small business in Oregon. In fact, as I said before, over half of the businesses have just a very, very small number of employees, and only 7 states have a higher percentage of businesses with 1 to 4 employees. Some information about how old our businesses are in terms of how long they've been in business. More than half of the companies were founded after 1985. So, and that's actually a good thing. When you talk about trying to stimulate the economy, the more business starts you have, the better you're going to have an opportunity to reap the results of those starts and the jobs that are created and the revenues from it down the road. In terms of survival rate, it's one of the myths that's been around for a long time is that half of all the businesses fail within the first year or couple of years. That's actually not true. The reality is actually most of the businesses survive. In fact, Oregon does very, very well in terms of our overall survival rate. In Oregon, 62% will make it the first year. If they make it the next after that, it goes up to 76%, and then after that, it goes up to 81%. And so we actually have a very strong survival rate of our businesses, which is a good thing. Here's another statistic that's quite interesting, because it again shows the way the businesses are arranged in terms of income. We rank 16th in the nation in the percentage of businesses grossing $500,000 or less. If you look, 83% of the businesses, I know it's hard to read that slide, but if you're following along in the handout, 83% of the businesses in the state of Oregon gross less than $500,000. That's $500,000 a year or less. So these are small operations, and yet they're vital to the economic prosperity of Oregon. When When you look at firms by industry, service businesses make up the largest portion. 35% of the businesses are in service, 23% in trade, 7% in manufacturing, and then finance, insurance, and real estate are 8%. One of the things that's a little troubling, this is actually from about 2 years ago. I don't have the most current information, but a fellow by the name of Dr. David Birch is the most expert person in the country on small business starts and entrepreneurship and what it really takes to have a thriving economy, and he studies over 10 million businesses every year nationally and gives rankings on how folks are doing on their entrepreneurship. Unfortunately, Oregon is not doing as well as we ought to be doing in terms of what he considers to be a hot spot, and this is based upon the growth of our businesses. We were 34th in 2000, dropping down from 7 slots from where we were in 1999. We need to do better than that if we're going to revitalize the economy. Let me give you the most recent data on firms by size that's quite interesting. If you look at the chart, I know it's difficult to read it here, but if you look at the chart that we have, that I provided for you, it gives you the data by size of firm on the number of firms from 1998 through 2002. And you can see that we've lost firms in most categories, businesses in most categories, with the exception of the zero category. So what does that mean? What's that? Those would be sole proprietors who have started, often laid off workers. We find that in our business it's very counter-cyclical. The more devastated the economy is, the more folks get laid off, the more people out of necessity are trying to start their own business. So that's why we're seeing a large increase in that zero category. Which really influences this slide, which shows that from 2000 through 2001, we actually had a net increase of 2.1% growth rate. But most of that, as I said, we're in the sole proprietor businesses. The next two slides, I think, are the really most interesting that are relevant to what we're talking about today, which is the economy and where's the growth come from in the jobs. And that this deals with employment broken out by size of business for the last 4 years. And if you look at this, you can see what's happened is that in 2002, for example, every single category has lost employment. But when you break that down, by what's happened to jobs, we lost lots of jobs from 2001 to 2002. But 35,000 jobs were lost by employers that have more than 50 employees, and 11,000 were lost by businesses that have 49 or fewer employees. Our smaller businesses tend to be more resilient. They tend to hold on to their workers if they can. It's hard to find workers. When you finally get someone that you want to work with, that you want to keep that employee. And so this is I think very important to consider from a public policy standpoint. Where are we going to put the emphasis? Is it going to be on large businesses or small businesses? I for one would suggest that particularly in rural areas, it's the small businesses that are helping maintain the economy and will help in the economic recovery. I'd like to share with you now a report that was commissioned by the Economic Development Department. It's a small business assessment from the year 2000, and all of the small business programs that are funded through the Economic Development Department participated in this assessment. There were 735 interviews. Many thousand businesses were included, but they selected 735 interviews, which was a very representative sample, plus or minus 4% reliability. In 2002, those businesses that were served through the Economic Development Department, through these programs, increased sales of $74 million And here's the really staggering figure, created 2,900 jobs. So that 11,000 negative would have been more, I think, had it not been for some of the assistance that's been provided through these programs. And $50 million in new payroll. If you'll bear with me, I'll just go through a couple more slides to tell you a little bit about our program. We receive part of our funding through the Economic Development Department, about 25% or 26% through the Economic Development Department, about 24% from the Small Business Administration, and the majority of it actually comes through the community colleges, which is really an important partner in our program. SBDCs, we have 19 of them located at 16 community colleges and 3 universities throughout Oregon. A quick summary of what we do. We provide confidential business counseling, business training, and information and assistance to businesses either getting started, if they're new to getting started businesses, or existing businesses. In fact, about 70+% of our businesses are existing businesses. They're not new businesses. We help them with business plan development, marketing plan development, accounting assistance, and developing new products, or sometimes personnel issues. Profile of our business owners. Very much mirror the state demographics, except that you'll see that we have a much higher percentage of manufacturing businesses. This is a good thing. That's what is also known as traded sector. The manufacturing businesses generally pay higher wages, and they also generally bring in more revenues to an area. So that's a positive. In terms of our client demographics, 40% of our clients are women, 10% minorities, and 60% are located in rural areas. I mentioned the budget. As you can see from this chart, 24% of our funding comes from the U.S. Small Business Administration, 48% from the community colleges and universities, and then 28% from the state of Oregon through lottery funds through the Economic Development Department. It's a great partnership. This is the data just on the Small Business Development Center program that came from that study, that assessment that was done by the Economic Development Department. In 2002, SBDC businesses added 2,676 new jobs. There were 1,100 new businesses that got started. $66 million in new sales, $44 million in new payroll. And we're particularly proud, actually, of the client rating of the quality of our services. Our clients gave us very high marks on a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being the highest you can get. 4.3 on business plan assistance, 4.2 marketing plan assistance, 4.3 on accounting assistance, 4.0 on new product and services, and 4.1 on personnel management assistance. Let me stop with that and then open this up for any questions that you may have. I'd be happy to answer any questions or to provide more information.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cutler. I have a quick question on the 1,100 new businesses in Oregon. Are you seeing a decline in the number of people who do want to start a new business because of all the, bad economy that we're suffering from?
Right now, we're actually seeing an increase in the number of people that want to start new businesses because of how the problems in the economy. So when people get laid off, they need to find something, and so very often that one of the things that they'll turn to is to become an entrepreneur, to start their own business. So we actually have seen an increase during a bad economy.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Berger?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned traded sector jobs, which are the more valuable in terms of we're not just feeding ourselves. Is this something that you as an organization emphasize, traded sector, or you just, I noted that you're correct, your statistics for traded sector is higher than the state as a whole. Is this something that you do as a setup, as a policy? Are you trying to get these manufacturing things going?
Chair Smith, Representative Berger, yes. In fact, some years ago, there was some policy direction from the legislature that suggested that we needed to focus on more traded sector businesses, and we made a conscious effort to focus on traded sector businesses, just as we've made a conscious effort to focus on more on existing businesses rather than startups. Not that startups aren't important, they are, but we found that we can have more impact if we can help people that are already in business and have gone through some of those growing pains become more successful. So yeah, the answer is yes, we have focused more on traded sector businesses.
Any other questions for Mr. Cutler? Representative
Hunt? To some degree, following up on Chair Smith's question, if you look, maybe project out, or look back at the last few years, how have the services that you've been providing changed, or how do you project that they're going to change, either in response to dealing with the state of the economy or just in response to the changing needs of business? Are there specific things you're doing differently or anticipate doing differently in the next years to come?
Chair Smith, Representative Hunt, yes, thank you for that question. Yes, the answer is yes, there are differences. The most specific example I could give right now is that electronic commerce, e-commerce, has become a very, very important part of all business operations, unless you're perhaps a small pizza parlor or a small service business. But even then, you can make a case. So, yes, we, for example, did some very intensive training with our businesses in the last 2 years on how to become successfully engaged in electronic commerce, kind of the pros and cons. There are some pitfalls as well. We'll be doing more in terms of delivering some of our services online counseling, rather than having to sit down face-to-face. Won't replace that, but it will be an addition. As we see the marketplace change, and it has a lot in the last several years, the priorities change as well. In the past, financing has been a critical issue, sometimes at the top of the list. Right now, we see lots of issues around personnel and having a qualified workforce. We hear over and over again from the small businesses that finding qualified workers, being able to hire them and train them, and then to retain them is one of their biggest challenges. Larger businesses have staffs and they have the wherewithal to do that. Small businesses have to do it themselves. So to answer your question, yes, we try and change. We do change based upon what the needs of our clients are.
Okay. Can I ask one follow-up to that?
Sure.
I mean, based on perhaps those two areas, e-commerce, qualified workforce, both hiring and retention, or any other category that comes to mind, what are the kind of things, as you're looking at us, that you would identify as things that we need to be more focused on, aggressively focused on, and I won't limit,
Sure.
Tax policy, regulatory policy, you name it.
Right. Chair Smith, Representative Hunt, the things that we hear over and over again are, one is regulatory reform. Whatever you all can do, and from a policy standpoint, we're going to start with that, to simplify, to streamline, to make it easier for businesses to do business is helpful. One of the things that I've suggested many, many years ago and over is that I think that every department within state government that actually has a regulatory function, either a permit or regulations, ought to also have their own internal small business advocate who has on staff, not a new position, and out of an existing position, and those folks ought to get together regularly, once a quarter, with all the different agencies, and talk about what regulations can we streamline. How can we make it easier for small businesses to comply, so that they don't have to go to four or five different agencies? A one-stop clearinghouse, and I think it starts within the agency themselves and having the folks get together and share information. So regulatory is one thing. The next area is adequate funding for community colleges and universities that are providing the majority of the funding for this program. If you really believe that what we do is valuable, there has to be adequate funding. And it's not just through the Economic Development Department. They've been great, and they've been wonderful partners. But we need to have the funding to the community colleges or else the program can't be successful. That's for the worker training and in order to provide the management skills that we provide.
Thank you. Representative Mark?
Thank you. Dr. Cutler, could you walk me through that, the survival rate thing again? You said in the first year, 62% or 63%, 62.9% of the firms survived past the first year.
Chair Smith, Representative Marks, that's correct. This is data from the corporate demographics. This is the David Birch study. So that means that if a business starts today, 62.9% of them will still be in business
at the end of
a year.
Okay.
Okay, and then it goes up after that because they learned some things.
Of the ones that finished the first year,
right?
76% will make it. 76.5 will make it to 5 years.
Correct.
So actually, that means only 48% of the original number of firms will still be in business.
I think what it means, as I understand, as I interpret this data, is that when you start, if you make it the first year, then it's an incremental difference. It's not like 76% of the 62% that if 62% make it the first year and then included in that group, then they keep going, then it goes up because they learn some things about how to be successful in doing business. Am I making sense?
Well, yeah, the numbers don't seem to. Normally, I would look at a survival rate over time, and you'd say there's going to be fewer and fewer over time,
right?
Because they're going to drop out, and so I've never seen one described in this way where they're actually gaining. Other than saying, well, yeah, of the remainder. So
right.
The actual survival rate
right.
declines.
I understand.
Okay. I had one other question, if you don't mind. Thank you. On the your new business starts and new jobs and such, I don't know, you've got a couple different figures here. One is $44 million in new payroll, $66 in new sales, or there's another one that's slightly more than that, $74 and $50 million in new payroll.
Yes.
So I don't know that if they're from the sort of the same data set or...
Chair Smith, Representative March, thank you for asking that question. It is from the same data set. The Economic Development Department manages a number of small business programs. In fact, in the audience today, Pat Allen is the small business manager, and he could speak and answer any specific questions. But this was all the same data set. The first set of numbers I gave you were for all small business programs, including minority and women. There are, for example, the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs gets some funding, as we do, from the Economic Development Department. They were also included in that larger data set. We then took just the piece of the SBDC piece, and that's what I showed you on the lower number in sales and job creation. It was just the SBDC portion of that.
Okay. Follow-up. Then... So, in the 74 million, let's say we take the 74 million in increase in sales, that's in gross sales, I presume, rather than net, and that would, what would be the cost of goods other than wages that would be in a 74 million sales?
Chair Smith, Representative March, I don't have that information because it would really depend on whether it was a service business or a manufacturing business or a wholesale business. Your cost of goods varies dramatically depending on the type of business. I don't have that data.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Richardson?
A couple questions. Dr. Cutler, I was looking at your Oregon size of firm data. I see that we've lost about 563 firms in the last year that employed 10 or more employees. Can you give us an idea as to why that would happen? Especially there's 360 that were between 10 and 50 employees, which would really be more of the small business. What is the basis for the loss?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, I don't have the data to provide that. I could get with the employment department who provided this information to us on the number of firms, Art Aaron, ask him if he could begin to give us some examples. Part of the the problem when you look at, when you get data like this, is that the employment department has some confidentiality standards that don't allow us to identify specific firms. But I will be happy to get to Mr. Ayer and talk about if I can get some examples of what happened rather than specific firms.
Okay, Paul. Mm-hmm. The reason I bring it up, of course, is that it's easier to help people stay in business than to create businesses from scratch. And if we knew what the basis was for such a huge number, 563 firms is a tremendous number of businesses we've lost, maybe we could lessen some of the losses in the future. Can you tell me, does SBDC spend much time or effort? I don't know if it's part of, I don't know the organization, but does it spend much time assisting small businesses that are already in business to help them succeed or continue to grow rather than just working on new businesses coming in?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, absolutely. In fact, I kind of went through it quickly, but 73% of the SBDC clients, Small Business Development Center clients, are existing businesses. And we've worked very, very hard with them to keep them in business. That's, and particularly at times like this, it's challenging. And it's around management. It's around being efficient. It's personnel. It's business planning. It's developing strategies that are going to allow you to stay in business for another, at least through the slow times, and then hopefully when things pick up, we'll benefit from that as well. But absolutely, yes, the majority of our clients, 73%, are existing businesses.
Okay. If there's a business that is struggling, how do they know to contact you for help?
Okay. Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, any number of ways. We work closely with the Chambers of Commerce. The Economic Development Department might refer someone if they went there and were in trouble. The Small Business Administration is a partner and a funder. We work very, very closely with local economic development districts in their local communities. The SBDC folks are very well networked in their local communities.
Okay, final question. If the legislature or a group were to determine that there was a need for additional businesses in a field, say that there was a market that was developing and it needed to be filled and we wanted to promote having Oregon businesses fill that market, is that something that the SBDC could help with, or would you refer us to someone else?
Representative Chair Smith and Representative Richardson, we could help with it depending on the expertise that we happen to have on in our own within our own network. We have done that in the past. For example, we have a very, very close strategic alliance with the Oregon Restaurant Association, because the number one startup and also the number one failure is our business, our restaurants. And so we work very closely with them. We've actually written software called Business Plan Pro for restaurants and have a strategic alliance with the Restaurant Association to work with their owners to make sure that they have access to that if they want to. In the past, we've done special programs for nursery growers and up in the Clackamas area. We had a program that was designed to work with, because nurseries was very much a growing business. We can, depends on our own expertise and of course adequate funding, we can help design and customize programs tailored to different industries, again, given the expertise and the resources.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Cutler. It's been very informational. And I would suggest if any of the committee members have anything else, you'd be glad to provide them with.
Thank you for the opportunity, and I will get back to Representative Richardson, if I can, on that data around on the firms. And thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate being here.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I'm going to close the informational hearing, or meeting, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2299. And Mr. Burton, I believe today is going to give us the second part of House Bill 2299, or another part, on the Strategic Investment Program.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about the Strategic Investment Program and also the Small Cities Business Incentive Program that was the subject of a bill that's already been introduced to the House Bill 2299. I'm Mike Burton. I'm the Assistant Director of the Economic and Community Development Department, for the record. And I thought before I started in on new territory, I'd ask if after rumination, anybody would come up with a question based on what I had to say on Monday. So would it make sense to...
Sure.
I don't think I'm going to take
fair.
A lot of time today on this stuff. So if I...
Did the committee have any questions? Apparently not. I think a lot of them wanted to wait for amendments, and we'll go back through it, I'm sure, again at a later date. But thank you for offering.
I'm actually disappointed in that. I thought the reason I didn't have questions was because I did such a good job of explaining.
Oh,
could you believe still shell shocked?
I think it's probably a combination, but we'll err on your
Mark.
Side.
I would believe that. Since there are no questions related to Monday's testimony, I will launch into the other two programs covered in the bill. They are the Small Cities Business Development Program, and as I mentioned, to remind you, that was a program created by Representative Butler in the last session. It was brand new in the last session and was meant to provide an incentive for businesses that might start up in the most distressed parts of the state. I think partly because it was a new idea and hadn't been tried, there were some glitches in the program, and Representative Butler has presented to you in his bill some adjustments to those problem areas. His bill also includes some changes in policy. This bill, 2299, only attempts to address the unforeseen barriers to successful participation in that program and doesn't get into any policy questions. We understand that an outcome of the fact of the two bills might be that that section of this bill might be moved into the other bill. But I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about what we're trying to do with that, with this bill and those elements. Then I would move on to the Strategic Investment Program, which is the other end of the spectrum. The Strategic Investment Program was invented in 1993 and was really driven by Intel, which was saying the semiconductor fabrication plants are huge investments, over $1 billion, most of them. Intel came to the department and said, the tax structure here is heavily biased toward property taxes. We're potentially going to make huge property investments, and the tax structure here is frankly prohibitive. Additionally, we're not going to create impacts on the school system, the municipal service system that's commensurate with those investments, so we'd like you to cut us a special deal. The department spent some time with the company and came to the legislature with a program that attempts to balance the investment and the property taxes with the actual demand on the system. It came up with a program that's negotiated at a number of levels, and one that resulted in the investment of about $12 billion. Put that into perspective, the assessed valuation of downtown Portland is about $2 billion. So the program was hugely successful. And we're proposing some changes. The changes we're proposing in these programs are a mix of substantive and technical corrections, unlike the enterprise zone stuff, which was almost entirely technical corrections. So I'm going to start walking through those elements. And first, I'm going to, as I said, get to the small business development incentive program. The criteria, this program requires that a business be looking at an investment, starting up operations in a county that is among the highest quartile of unemployment, the top nine counties in unemployment, and to say top highest nine counties in unemployment, and the lowest nine counties in income, per capita income, or average annual wage in the statute. So you've got to meet both of those criteria, and there are four counties that do that at this time. They are, let's see if I can keep this from memory, Lake, Crook, Sherman, and Morrow counties. The bill, as it was written, requires fairly rapid investment and startup. Basically, you qualify for a period of time, you've got to start, you've got to get certified, the business has to get certified to do business, and it has to start operation within a given tax year. So part of the amendments are to address that, and part of them are to address a point that Representative Butler raised when he was here, which is that the language doesn't define the boundaries of the city. The first change the department proposes that's substantive is to clarify that boundaries of a city means the urban growth boundaries of the city. You may recall that Representative Butler went beyond that and talked about industrial sites that, you know, existing industrial sites that might be outside of an urban growth boundary, but the department didn't take the step and go beyond clarifying what was meant by boundaries of the city. So the first change is on page 2 of the bill and clarifies that you will mean urban growth boundaries. Also on page 2 of the bill, we tried to take one of the steps to address the question of timing. The issue is that the statistics are published annually. One of them is actually published monthly. By rule, we decided that we wouldn't look at the monthly fact of employment data, but we'd look at an annual average. And essentially what that means is an area qualifies for the exemption and needs to make the rounds and contact businesses. This was intended as a recruiting program. So ideally, they would be reaching out to businesses that might be interested in locating in their community and selling them on coming to Lake County or Crook County or Sherman or Morrow in this case. If the exemption only lasts for a year, it doesn't make a lot of sense to publish materials to build a case and to try to get a business to come, remembering that they have to be in operation in the tax year. So we've proposed on lines 5 and 6 that once the intention of the language is that once a community reaches that eligibility threshold, becomes on those two intersecting quartiles of unemployment and per capita income, or average annual income, that they would have 2 years to market and solicit businesses that would then be eligible. So to give them a little bit of time to invest in an effort to incent businesses to come to their county. I keep saying per capita income instead of average annual income. That was one of the changes that was in 2020.
Madam Chair. Mr. Burton, so this means that a community that today might not be qualified could look back 2 years and could be.
Chair Smith, Representative March, that's the result of the language that we've put forward is that would be the case. It wasn't our intention. Our intention was that once you get qualified, you have 2 years to make it. You may recall the list that where we compared the impact of the current law with 2298 and 2299. The difference in the 2299 list is going back 2 years and looking to see who would then be eligible. So the way the language is written, that is exactly the case.
Thank you.
Okay. Also related to the timeliness, moving on to page 4, lines 28 and 29, the current law requires, first, allows for a comment period. The department makes certification and notifies the cities and counties that are involved. They have 60 days to respond. So there's a comment period before the department can issue a pre-certification. Then the business, upon receiving pre-certification, has to be in business in 6 months. Additionally, it has to be within the tax year. So we thought it would be useful to, instead of defining that timeline within 6 months, to say that they've got to get on with building their facility and get in operation. So proposed language that we think allows a business to understand the incentive, apply to the department, go through the comment period, and then make whatever investments they need to get in operation.
Yes.
Why not just to keep things clear and keep, you know, yard markers there, why not just go to a year?
Chair Smith, Representative Haas, If it's a meaningful investment, if it's a building, a construction project, we don't see how the current law can basically allow for it. It would be almost impossible to do the notice period and then construction and be in operation. So whether or not it's not given that it has to be a construction project. So reasonable might depend on the nature of the improvements that the business needs to make in order to get in operation. And we would propose that by rule we'll define what it means, what reasonable means, and that if it doesn't work, we can make an adjustment under rule. But the idea is to allow business to respond to the incentive, make their investment decisions, make the investments, and then pull them to the business.
Thank you. Mr. Wirt, could you maybe jot down a couple of those kind of ideas for us and bring, you know, of what you might include within that proposed rule, i.e., you know, within 60 days or 6 months of completion of construction, or, you know, of, you know, if it's a maybe the existing building acquisition, you know, that they've gotten a permit change to of use or whatever, you know, kind of give us some ideas of what the sidebars are there and reasonable.
Okay.
Thanks.
There's no representative March. That's not a problem. The last change we're proposing, the last substantive change, I should say, is that the current law says that the firm can not be in the same business anywhere else in the state. And the intention of that, based on conversations with Representative Butler, was to preclude somebody from packing up and moving to another part of the state. Or, you know, we want this tax credit, so we're going to change our corporate structure and become a new company, and we'll qualify for the tax. What we're proposing is, what we really care about is additional jobs, additional payroll, and we're proposing that we allow for somebody to stay in operation in Eugene, if that's where they are, and also do a plant in Lakeview as long as they don't move their people from Eugene and reduce their employment substantially in Eugene in order to get the Lakeview plant going. So that's essentially what we're proposing to do with this part of the bill, with just technical corrections, essentially.
Representative Pine?
How would you define substantially in rule, or do you have a sense of what substantially reduce would actually mean?
Chair Smith, Representative Hunt, we would define it in rule. The normal standards are something on the order of 10%. And we would also typically look for the relative health of the areas involved. We've had limitations like this in law in the past and continue to have them. And if, for instance, well, it's not entirely true in Corvallis anymore these days. Corvallis has had an unemployment rate for since the early 70s on the order of 2 or 3%. It's up a little bit now, but it's still much better than the rest of the state. If someone were to consider opening an operation in Pineville, which is well over 10%, we might be a little more flexible in terms of a reduction in Corvallis than, say, if they were to move from Harrisburg to Prineville. But basically, relative to the place they're leaving or expanding from, we would propose a little bit of flexibility. But essentially, if they're moving, we wouldn't allow for reduction in a place that has adverse or labor surplus now, high unemployment now. In the past, some Oregon firms have looked at the situation in Portland and felt like they couldn't do a meaningful expansion in Portland. So they found other parts of the state where they felt they could expand, Oregon Dental Services being a company that opened an operation in LeGrand and now employs about 50 people in LeGrand, because they felt like they couldn't. They'd already exhausted the available labor supply for their kind of employees in the Portland area. At the time, Portland had very low unemployment, and this rule would have allowed some flexibility in allowing a more positive impact in another part of the state. If you'd like, I can also get examples of some of this. Okay, that's all we had in mind for the small cities and towns. Any questions before I leave that?
Representative Hass.
Do you have any history on how what's happened in the last year or two?
Chair Smith, Representative Haas, we've not yet seen a firm before this incentive.
Thank you.
Chair Smith, members of the committee. I'm going to move on to the strategic investment program, and we've put together a sort of a background piece on the program. As I said, these are meant to be very large investments, and typically they only take place in large metropolitan areas because there's a large employment component that goes along with the size of the investment. These are traded sector businesses, and we'll hear from Mr. Cutler and Dr. Cutler what those are. The exemption is for up to 15 years on project property. 7 to 15 years is what the law says. The exemption does not apply until investment is over $100 million. It doesn't apply on the first $100 million of investment. And then commensurate with inflation in the property tax laws, it's allowed to increase at 3% a year after that. The department or the commission must approve the exemption on these projects, and the city, county, or a relevant jurisdiction must also approve the exemption. An important part of that is that it becomes a negotiated process. Deals are cut on this, and part of the sizing the payments in lieu of taxes, if you will, to the impact of the investment. Remember, these are disproportionately large investments relative to the impact they make. In fact, there's a well-publicized, the last one at Intel was the one where they had to promise not to create jobs. But in lieu of job creation, there was an understanding that they weren't going to significantly impact the school system, fire department. So it was felt to be a fair trade. But the important thing is these are negotiated projects. It's not a done deal like the other ones would be. There is a requirement for a first source hiring agreement, as we discussed the other day with the Enterprise Zone program. I've already mentioned that the local discretion may entail additional procedures, requirements, and agreement. It may be that they do impact the fire department. And so there may be a requirement that they address that with the fire department. You know, a case in point would be some of these are large buildings. I'm aware of one project where the fire department that had to cover it didn't have a way to get on top of the building, and the company bought them a hook and ladder truck, essentially, to get up on top of the building. So there's an opportunity here for certain provisions to deal with a specific impact. There is, on the amount over $100 million, a community services fee. That fee is either $2 million or 25% of the property tax savings, whichever is larger. So essentially, unless other conditions are negotiated, there's a cap on taxes on the investment over $100 million of $2 million. So with the tax on the first $100 million and this fee, you can see that there's still a very large tax impact on the jurisdiction. I think I've pretty much, I'll go through the characteristics of the projects we've seen so far. All of them have been semiconductor fabrication plants, and there's actually a list a couple pages back on the exemptions currently in place. But they've all been very large. They've all had an extremely large capital investment for the number of employees they have. They tend, because they're heavily capital intensive, to employ well-trained and well-compensated workforce. But investment in the workforce is typically small relative to the capital investment, but it tends to be a large relative to the individual employees. They've had large impacts on other parts of the economy. Typically, they're large consumers of services from other firms. And relative to the size of the investment, they've had a low impact on public services. So would anybody like to ask questions about about what the program is or how it works before I move on to the changes?
Thank you, Mr. Burton. Madam Chair and Mr. Burton. do you have any information on the total value of the exemptions here to the firms? I know you've got a column here for the investment, and I assume the value of the exemption is going to be relatively proportional to the investment with the caveats of the community service fee, $2,025,000. Are those figures available somewhere?
They are available. Chair Smith, Representative Marsh, they are available. I didn't bring them. They're not absolutely proportional. As you point out, there is that cap on the community service fee. So these are well over $100 million investments, and they run into that cap. Okay. So I can get you that information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, I'll move on to our proposed changes. And I did include a subset of the little line-by-line explanation tailored to this particular piece. And in the order that it appears in the statute, which is a little bit different than the order it appears on that sheet, first, we would allow for electrical generating facilities. Since the originally, for reasons I can't remember, the program excluded electrical generating facilities. Most of the time, that wasn't an issue, but lately, we've seen this boom of very large cogen plants, gas turbine generating facilities, which are having the same sorts of impacts on, or lack of impacts relative to the investment, and the same disproportionate tax impact, given the large investment that the semiconductor fabs have. There is interest in moving those exemptions into this program because it is a negotiated program. They currently are eligible for enterprise zones exemptions if they're in an enterprise zone, which has created a lot of pressure on enterprise zones. The last competition was largely driven by the fact of potential electrical generating facilities. And there are some concerns related to that. There are concerns related to airshed capacity because these things tend to concentrate in one place. There are concerns about where the construction work goes. There are concerns that really can't be addressed in the Enterprise Zone program, but because this is a negotiated process, would be a good fit for this. We're not excluding them from the Enterprise Zone program in this legislation, but on the so smaller power plants would still receive an incentive, but the very large ones would receive a larger benefit in this program. So it's our expectation that this will drive the more controversial and very large plants into this negotiated arena. So that's why we're including those plants in this program at this point, or we're proposing to do that. The second change is on page 5 of the bill, and what we're trying to do here is slant the program, make the program available in rural areas, with the exception of those very large electrical generating facilities. It's unlikely that any of this activity will happen in rural communities because of the commensurate job creation. So we're trying to create a scaled-down version for rural communities, which are defined on page 5, line 31. But essentially, we're saying that we're grabbing the threshold to $25 million and proportionally reducing the community service fee and saying we'd allow a smaller project to meet the standard in rural communities. And I guess the third change is that reference I just made to the reduction in the community service. The fourth change is one that is still controversial and unresolved. This is one I was asked on Monday if who wouldn't be comfortable with the bill. This is one that we've not resolved and are still negotiating. But as I mentioned on Monday, there has been concern in the past on all of these programs in the current tax environment because taxing entities feel that, particularly those that don't have a say in the program, essentially cities and counties negotiate this program, largely the enterprise zone program, but we've required for new enterprise zones that taxing districts be notified and be allowed an opportunity to voice their concerns about the designation of the zone. But they feel that the taxing entities feel like they're at the limit of what they can afford to forego. And this bill, this provision of this bill, would allow an option for special districts. I need to explain that the option is fairly limited. We're told by the Attorney General's office that if there's an exemption in place, so if you look at the list of existing exemptions, which are essentially Multnomah and Washington counties, if there's an exemption in place, or as long as there's an exemption in place, it can't be a different election by the taxing entities. They've got to treat everybody fairly. And so as long as there's an exemption in place, the opt-out is not available. Therefore, for 7 years in Multnomah County and for 11 years in Washington County, there wouldn't be an option for the taxing entities. Once there's a period of time where there's no exemption in place, then an option becomes available. That option would then stick until any other exemptions would run their lifetime. This is probably the most complicated part of this, and it's one that's not resolved. We'll probably be back to you as we work through it with the cities, counties, and special districts. So there'll probably be an amendment in this area. Finally, on page 6, and this is driven by the Microchip Technologies Project in Gresham, but Microchip Technologies bought the Fujitsu plant. Fujitsu had qualified the exemption but had never collected on it, and Microchip Technologies made it clear that that was a critical part of their investment decision. So we're asking to clarify that a company acquiring an exempted business would be able to continue the exemption. The rationale is that it was worth it in the beginning. It should continue to be worth it. Disproportionate investment still is disproportionate. So the rest of the changes in both of these are essentially refinements of language and not substantive changes. I'd be happy to have you go out of the room. We can't do that yet. But I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Gallego. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm hoping maybe you could help guide me through in the it's page 5, line 25, the eligible project talks about the needs to meet criteria that's been established by OECD. And then down line 37, some of those changes that the project is eligible. And then it says again, if the project is an eligible project. Where's the criteria? Point me to the criteria that tells me that it's been met. And where's the definition of an eligible? I mean, because I kind of feel like I'm going in a circle there when I'm looking for the eligible project and the criteria.
I'm going to ask Mr. Fish to help us find this because I don't know the statute well enough to identify it right now.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Hello. For the record, I'm Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And again, thank you. It's a pleasure to address the committee. Chair Smith, members of the committees, Representative Gallegos. It says you're looking, I think, at page 5, line 40. Project is an eligible project. I think that's, that's just simply saying that it meets the definition under starting there on line 25.
But that says, well, that meets the criteria. Where is that criteria outlined?
Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos, this is one of those places where we've just moved things around with one exception. So we moved it down to lines 40 through 45. The exception in that is line 44, which is the new rural threshold. That's a change. The rest of it.
Let me explain. On line 22, it gives the current definition of an eligible project. Eligible project has the meaning giving that term in ORS 285B323. Well, that's not in front of you.
Right.
And that's where it says that an eligible project is an economic development project. An economic development project includes anything that's not electric generation. So right now, under the law, anything is eligible except for electrical generation. The change here would, in fact, mean...
With these additional criteria.
Well, the other criteria are in addition to being eligible. So you're eligible in the future under this bill based on criteria that the commission would set, the Oregon Economic Development Commission, which is appointed by the governor and so forth. And what criteria they would set at this point, I'm not sure. It would confirm that it has to be a traded sector company, which is already required here, but they might deal with the energy issue. What energy projects? There might be some criteria, but essentially the idea is to open it up And so right now, that would be
it's
the idea.
It's not defined, is what you're telling me.
It's not defined. It would be defined subject to the commission.
Sure,
which approves these, which has to authorize these projects.
The definition in statute are these threshold limits that are here.
Which is all but the line 44, but it says an eligible project.
Mm-hmm.
It's an eligible project if it's an eligible project. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm trying to figure out what... It's an eligible project, line A, if it's an eligible project. So we just went in a circle there, and that's where I'm trying to figure out what the eligible... What line A refers to.
Maybe Kim can share. If I can just point you to line 34 through 37, basically that's the current state of the statute, is
right.
The department has the ability to determine what is an eligible project. And until they make a rule, that's all we have is the circular definition.
Chair Smith, Representative The current, the change we're proposing is to allow in electrical generating facilities. We're not proposing to limit this except in terms of the size of the projects. If it were the pleasure of the committee, we could visit that question. But right now, with the exception of electrical generating facilities, all large investments qualify for this exemption. Or actually, they're in a position to negotiate the exemption. It's never an automatic. It's always in good.
Right. I'm just trying to understand what the criterion. I couldn't follow that frame.
Sure,
but I'm not meant to, I think, is the answer.
No, I understand what you're saying. And at this point, I don't understand. But,
okay.
But the practice of the department and the commission has been to use the threshold of size as the criteria for a qualification. There are very few of these projects. To my knowledge, there's been one other project that would have qualified for this exemption that chose to not pursue this exemption, and that was, at the time, Hyundai and Eugene, which instead went after the normal enterprise zone exemption. There aren't very many of these, and we've chosen not to, other than the statutory limitations, add to the limitations.
Thank you. Representative Hunt?
Thanks, Madam Chair. You talked about a couple of corrections you're trying to make in terms of including the electrical generation facilities and trying to have a provision that will address issues in rural communities. Do you have any sense? You talked about the fact that so far only semiconductor and only in those two counties have had projects. Is there anything you've looked at, or is there anything that might be looked at that would address other industries beyond semiconductor and looking at the other? And we've got significant population centers in Clackamas County and Marion County and Lane County. It strikes me as strange that we wouldn't have some opportunities to do some things there, much along the lines of you're trying to expand it out to include electric generation facilities and give an opportunity in rural counties. Is there anything you've looked at in that area or that could be looked at?
Chair Smith, the issue is the size of these projects. These are massive projects, and they just don't come along that much. The only things that I'm aware of that have come across at the 100 million threshold are semiconductor fabs and electric generation facilities. At the $25 million, there would be a broader range of investments that could qualify. You would see that as a meaningful threshold in the rural parts of the state. Although, again, the nature of these large projects is they tend to require a lot of people. I mean, relative to the investment, Hyundai, I'm familiar with Hyundai. Hyundai employed at its peak about 800 people. That's a large investment and would eliminate most communities from hosting the facility. But 800 people for an investment of $1.4 billion is not very much. It's a very capital-intensive project. So I don't expect to see very many of these show up, and our intention is not to limit the incentive that they do, because even with 800 people, the impact on the community of Eugene was very favorable, would have been favorable given these provisions, but was favorable under the enterprise zone. The exemption there ended up being about $45 million over the life of the enterprise zone.
It's a $1.4 billion investment that's paying taxes at the rate of $15 per thousand or whatever it is in Eugene now that the exemption's rolled over.
If I could follow, Madam Chair.
Looking then at the $25 million level, which may create more opportunities for projects, did you give any consideration to not having that applied just to rural areas, but apply to perhaps some of these other significant population counties that have significantly large unemployment, but for whatever reason haven't been able to meet the $100 billion threshold?
Chair Smith, Representative Hunt. We were essentially responding to repeated comments from economic development professionals in the rural communities saying, you've got this thing that works in the metro areas, but it doesn't work in our neighborhood. Help us find something that we can use. And we're responding specifically to that request. We're not considering dropping the threshold in urban areas. It would still be a large investment, but I'm aware of investments in Salem that would meet the $25 million threshold. And there's a question of whether or not you'd want to go there. Now, they're not a lot above $25 million. And remember, nothing's exempted until you get to that threshold. So I'm thinking specifically of the PPG plant out at the industrial park. It's a $33 million investment. I'm not sure how much they'd save. But if we eliminated or reduced the threshold to $25 million statewide, you'd see a number of projects become eligible.
If I could make one more comment, it just seems like in this environment where we're trying to do as much as we can to create jobs, especially when we've got such significant populations that for whatever reason aren't being impacted by semiconductors or aren't being impacted by that $100 million projects. Again, looking at areas like Clackamas County, Marion County, Lane County, big population centers, not rural, at least the areas where these plants would likely locate are not going to be defined as rural. I guess I just still have a question about should we consider looking at some level, if the $100 million threshold tends to be the problem there, if we should consider looking at something below that, maybe it's not 25, or maybe it is, that would not just be an exemption for rural areas, but might provide a tool for the department and those communities to have some economic incentives.
Chair Smith, Representative Hunt, I would propose that I don't think there are a lot of these investments, so I don't think it would be a huge piece of work to survey the tax rolls in Marion and Lane counties, for instance, and find out how many very large investments there are, and maybe get back to you with that.
That might be helpful.
Maybe inform the discussion a little bit.
With the definition of rural areas, too, the industrial land supply is critical. Yes, we have it here. Would you like her to read it?
Yeah.
Kim, why don't you read the definition, sir?
Definition of rural area contained in ORS 285A0107 means an area located entirely outside of the acknowledged Portland metropolitan area, regional urban growth boundary, and the acknowledged urban growth boundaries of the cities of 30,000 or more in population, including Albany, Bend, Corvallis, Eugene, Springfield, Salem, Kaiser, or Medford. Yes. Representative Hess.
Thank you. I was just wondering.
Excuse me, Chair, would you like us to take a look at a couple of counties and see what is involved?
I would think so. Would you?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, I think
it would
be
Clackamas as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Hess.
I was just curious in this line of questioning, what prompted this change to 25 million rural areas? Are there economic development nibbles that you see? You see opportunities there, or the companies who would come to rural areas with this lower cycle threshold?
Chair Smith, Representative Haas. This is a size, $25 million is a level of investment that does arise from time to time. I didn't come prepared with a list on recent recruitments, but it's a level that is real and comes up fairly routinely, and the PVG plant, I can't remember the employment, but I believe it's less than 100. So that would be something that would be a better fit for for smaller communities. It might be a real opportunity. Some sawmill investments, I mean, you'd have to be very large investments, but it's not out beyond the range of possibility.
What happens in 15 years in terms of program? What's the mechanics?
Chair Smith, Representative Haas. As I said, it's negotiated, so it's you can't say that this is always applied, but the potential is for 15-year exemption on property taxes and 15-year exemption on income taxes, subject property taxes subject to the minimum thresholds and community service fee. So you could see greatly limited property taxes and essentially no.
Well, I mean, at the end of that.
No, there is a minimum income tax, and then how is that?
So you're thinking long-term enterprise.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No income. We get the income.
Okay. Oh, okay. Right. Okay. We switched up programs and was talking about long-term rural again.
Well, I was just curious what happens to these retail plants at the end of 2010. What happens then?
Chair Smith, Representative Hoff, it's my personal belief that there's so much invested in the equipment of these plants, and it turns over so rapidly that at the end of 15 years, there's going to be very little value left in the building unless it still fits the footprint of the production operation. So this is a major exemption. I think you could see companies walking away from large buildings.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a follow-up for that because having, worked at Intel for many, many years, recognizing, they just had made a big investment in Arizona where these almost become disposable because of it's a huge investment, but their life cycle is very short. My question has to be, LSI logic, these are goals, employment goals, direct job. I'm assuming these are goals that need to be met in order to receive these tax credits, and LSI, I know, has had some recent layoffs. I mean, they're struggling. Are they currently receiving these tax benefiting, even though they're in this downward cycle, and therefore they continue to qualify?
Chair Smith, Representative Davis, yes, they're continuing to receive these things.
If I might, Chair Smith, Representative Gallegos, members of the committee, my understanding is that yes, they have to get up to 2,000 within the exemption period. Right now, whether it's a little less or more than they were recently, they've invested over $1 billion so far in actuality, and the employment is over 900.
There are negotiated conditions that may be in addition to the statutory conditions. I'm not familiar with what those are specifically.
Yeah.
Built,
so.
The contract is about this thick.
Oh, sure. So, and they're all with, we want to keep those people employed that are there. I mean, clearly and not yank this type of stuff, but
I'd be
concerned about, Representative Haas mentioned, if these are going to be disposable, are they quickly companies out building their infrastructure for the next 15 years where they walk away from some of these communities and we're left without jobs or maybe we need to, is this enough?
They can be reviewed, okay. Though. I mean, the contract, for example, LSI Logic in Multnomah County, they review that, the status of that contract every year and see how many jobs they're producing, and they report back to the Board of County Commissioners. And I assume that that they can withdraw the designation if they're not meeting their goals.
Depending on the circumstance of the agreement or where they fall relative to these thresholds, they may not have a choice. They may lose the exemption.
Automatic. Right.
Yeah.
Question?
Representative Richardson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Burton, is it correct that if we had representatives from, counties here, they would be saying, please remember that these things have a direct impact on the county, which is responsible for maintaining infrastructure and so forth. They're losing the property tax benefit in hopes that there will be an income tax benefit from the number of employees, which goes to the state. And is there a negative impact on municipalities?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson. So far, this is applied in Multnomah and Washington County and a couple of cities there, three cities, I think, and Beaverton, Portland, and Gresham. And they've all been willing participants in the deal. There's still a huge tax impact from these. It's just limited to represent the enormous investment, but they've been willing and eager participants.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you. Is there anything else? Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Next, we have Mr. Duke Shepherd, who wanted to testify. If you'd like to come forward. Thank you, and welcome for the record.
Thank you, Chair Smith, members of the committee. My name is Duke Shepherd. I represent Multnomah County Chair Diane Lynn on the Strategic Investment Program. And just to give you a little of my background, for the last 4 years, I managed the agreement with LSI Logic. And for a short time, also managed the agreements with Intel and IDT in Washington County. And this summer was part of the negotiating team to bring microchip to Gresham. So I'm hip deep in this program. And I would just, if I could speak briefly to the bill, which I'm not, I got to tell you, I'm not a complete expert on yet. I reviewed it last night and went through and found sort of the key points that I think would be problematic in the future for attracting these kinds of investments. What I would just like to say is this program's work as it's intended. We've got companies that would not be here. They simply would not be in Gresham without this program. LSI Logic still has the $15 million check from Red Rock, Texas, that they were handed that they could cash if they made the investment and locate there, and they didn't because of this program. With microchip, there were upwards of 20 vacant fabs around the country and around the world. Ours was the only one that met their needs, but even with that said, they had an empty fab in Puyallup, Washington, full of equipment that they could have turned on and chose to buy the one in Gresham because, while it was more up-to-date with the SIP, it made it much more cost-effective for them to do that. So the key pieces of the bill that jumped out to me are the abilities over time for special districts to opt out. It would make the program much more complex and really less attractive to a company. If a company is coming to Multnomah County, for example, and I realize the way the bill is worded now, we would sort of get a special dispensation, but that doesn't necessarily make it still an effective program. That if what we had to do was guard our ability to negotiate the agreement with a company by saying, well, yes, you get a tax abatement, and it's over the first $100 million of investment, but you may or may not really get the full abatement because other districts may, in fact, decide to tax you at the full rate. The complexity of their having to go to other districts and the uncertainty of what their tax liability would be, and the fact that this is that really who we're competing with is Singapore and China and not just even Chandler, Arizona, that we're the ability of our tax system long-term to compete with some of those complete freebies that are in other countries. The more complex we make these, the harder it is to make them happen. Now, saying that, the beauty of the program is that we can customize it, that we raise the bar on these companies, and, for example, LSI Logic has to meet a higher environmental standard than is required by state statute or DEQ, that we set workforce training and hiring requirements. To the representative's question about their being on track toward their job goals, the 2,000 is a cumulative figure over the life of the agreement. They are on track. It fluctuates from year to year. This industry is so cyclical that some years they'll be ahead of the curve and some years they'll be behind it. But they are on track to meet their 2,000 investment goal, 2,000 employee goal at the termination of the exemption. One other small technical piece that I would add, the 30-day notice that's required in this bill. I understand the interest in special districts being included. We would welcome to the table. We held hearings on the microchip deal this summer because we want to hear from the public and anybody who had an interest. But that example in particular, we couldn't have done 30-day written certified mail notice because we didn't know 30 days in advance if we were going to have a deal or a hearing. Furthermore, microchip was prevented. We were prevented from talking about it publicly because of SEC rules that they had notification requirements to their shareholders about their intent that had to be met before we could do anything publicly. So my bottom line is it's working. Let's not make it more complicated. I have absolutely no opinion on lowering the threshold for investment, That certainly sounds interesting. My bottom line is it's worked for us the way it is, and please just, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Do you have a question?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and Duke, thanks very much for being here. I was kind of trying to carry the ball of a little bit of my memory of the SIP program in Multnomah County, and I know Commissioner Collier was in and did a lot of that early negotiation. But since you were in on the more recent negotiation, could you kind of maybe just briefly tell us which parties had to agree to this agreement, like the City of Gresham had to agree, County had to agree, et cetera?
Sure. Chair Smith, Representative March. The process worked as basically this. The county was contacted by Microchip Technology. The State Economic Development Department helped bring them to us as well. We entered negotiations. Ourselves, the City of Gresham, both have equal power to approve this agreement. If one doesn't, it doesn't happen. So both had to approve it. Both negotiated terms that were satisfactory to each government. We held joint hearings for approval, and then each governing body approved the contract. And I would also add that there's a provision in the bill that addresses the community service fee that's generated that's equal to a quarter of the abated taxes or not to exceed $2 million. We would also, while we may be exempted the way the bill is drafted now, not look favorably upon changes to how the community service fee is dealt with either. Currently, it's divided on a basis that's negotiated among the city and the county. We divide it 53% to Multnomah County, 47% to the City of Gresham. It's in times like these, it's flexible revenue that, frankly, we need. And I would also add that, as the State Department mentioned, it's a net, even though there's a tax abatement, it is a net tax gain with the $100 million threshold for us. Right now, LSI and Microchip are two of the largest property taxpayers in Multnomah County, even with the abatement.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Pott. Whoops. Sorry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You talked about the co-negotiation between Gresham and Multnomah County in this case. If the special districts were, I don't know enough about Gresham to know, but I mean, how many special districts would come into play if they were a party to that negotiation?
Chair Smith, Representative Hunt, I honestly have not done the research to be able to tell you that. I looked at the bill last night, and the initial read on it was more parties would be at the table. I don't know if it would be one, none, or five.
I think we could get that answer for you. Representative Pass, did you have a question?
Just a comment, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming, Duke, and I think your point about this is a net tax gain. That doesn't even factor in the people who work there who own homes and property and pay taxes, not to mention income tax. I think the same is true, more so in Washington County.
May I add one more thing, Chair Smith? And Representative March had asked the question, I think, the previous speaker. I can give you ballpark off the top of my head what the abatement has been worth in a given year. LSI Logic, it's ranged between a tax abatement of $4 million to $6 million, and Microchips is expected to be about $1.6 next year. And that rises up and down based on their investment schedules and the assessed value, so it can swing a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shepard. Good information. Is there anybody else here who wants to testify on House Bill 2299? I thought you might want to.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I'm really not, as the department indicated, we are working on some amendments to the bill, and perhaps Diane Lynn's office would be interested in being participative in those amendments. I'll just say that to answer the question on the Multnomah County issue, very few. I can think of Multnomah County Drainage District, I think, that levies a property tax. Most of the special districts in Multnomah County don't have permanent rate authority. So in Multnomah County, it's really not an issue. But Washington County and Clackamas County, it's a very big issue. So I can think of maybe two taxing districts that have permanent property tax authority in Multnomah County. So it's really not not a big issue in Multnomah County, but we are working with the district, with the department on amendments with respect to the opt-out, and we hope to be able to come to some sort of consensus among all of the stakeholders and bring you back a happy, smiley amendment.
Well, thank you. Do we have any questions for Hasina? No, thank you very much. Seeing no one else who wants to testify, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2299. And committee, I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee bills. And we have LC 3185 before us. And Kim, would you like to give us a quick summary of what that does?
Sure. Madam Chair, if the committee will recall, this is the bill that was discussed at our committee meeting on February 5th when we met at SUMCO. The proposal coming forth that specifically will affect that company. But more generally, LC 3185 would permit an enterprise zone sponsor to approve the extension of a property tax abatement to a business that was qualified for the abatement but has been unable to maintain the required minimum employment requirements during the entire abatement period. This extension is only available to businesses that were pre-certified on or after January 1st, 2000 and before January 1st, 2001. Formal action by both the zone sponsor and the governing body of the zone sponsor is required on or before June 30th, 2004 to take advantage of this extension.
Thank you. And for the committee, you might explain the process of a committee bill for our new legislators.
Sure. To the extent you haven't been on a committee that has introduced a committee bill, a vote for introduction of this bill is not a vote in favor nor of the bill specifically, but rather a courtesy to have the bill introduced. It will then come back to the committee for your support or not support, depending on how you feel about the bill at that time.
And a full hearing at that time,
of course.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I move LC Draft 3185 to be introduced as a committee bill.
Well, Representative Gallegos has moved to LC Draft 3185 to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing and hearing no objection, motion carries, and LC Draft 3185 will be introduced as a committee bill. I will close the work session. Being no further business before the committee, I will adjourn.